On Sunday, November 29th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents vibraphonist, composer, educator, and 2016 NEA Jazzmaster recipient, Gary Burton. Join us as we discuss Gary Burton's career as a musician and educator. That's Sunday, November 29th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. The name of this program is Sugar in My Bowl, and our guest for this evening is vibraphonist, composer, and 2016 NEA Jazzmaster recipient, Gary Burton. Stay tuned. This should be a very enlightening show. I really had a great time talking to Gary Burton. Stay tuned. As mentioned, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, coming up now.
I want some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Thank you. I've been taking this year off as much as I could. For years, I've thought about doing that, and this year, the schedule just kind of broke a certain way, and I thought, okay, I did two major things with Pat Metheny that we'd had planned for a long time. It was one back in January, another one in September. We've been doing vacation trips and staying home and so on. I've enjoyed it, and I didn't miss the constant playing and road travel and everything. Everybody always said to me, oh, you know, you'll be bored to death. You'll get restless staying at home and everything. No, it's been really nice. I've enjoyed it a lot. It's a nice change of pace.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Gary Burton.
Gary Burton, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate the time that you're going to give us.
That's my pleasure.
Congratulations on, actually, you can explain it for me. You're an NEA Jazz Master, so have you already received the fruits of, you know, the gifts of being an honoree?
Well, it comes in stages.
Okay.
I've received the monetary grant already. They were very upfront, quick with that, which was nice.
Yes.
And now we're planning the actual sort of 3 days of events that take place in Washington at the Kennedy Center in April. There's a concert and a dinner event and the awards presentation and some educational presentations and so on. It's a whole extended event that goes on. And it's all kind of new to me. I was always aware of the Jazz Masters Awards, but never really knew quite what was involved. So it was definitely a nice honor to be selected this year.
Now, do you happen to know who nominated you?
No, as I understand it, anyone can nominate someone and turn in a biography and their reasons for why someone thinks they would be a good candidate and so on. And they keep the submission on file for 5 years.
Oh.
And so each year, theoretically, when they go through all the current nominees or recommendations, it's cumulative of over a five-year period. And I don't know who the people are, what kind of committee or group it is that actually makes the final selections or anything. It's kind of secretive in that regard, I guess.
Right.
But they pick three musicians, and they pick one non-musician, someone who is a jazz sort of support person. There's been club owners, concert promoters. This year, it's a woman in New York whose last name is escaping me now, Wendy.
You
almost said it there. she has run a jazz service organization for a long time.
The Jazz Foundation of America.
Yeah, supporting mostly elder jazz musicians who are having challenges dealing with their living situations and their finances and so on, which is a very worthy cause. So she's the fourth honoree this year.
Yes. I'm happy to hear about all the recipients this year. This is a particularly wonderful year, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Just to let people know, you wrote an autobiography.
I did, yes.
Titled Learning to Listen. A Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. First, I want to refer people to that because they're not going to get that here. They're going to get all that information by listening to tonight's program. But do you want to share a little bit about how you came about doing it? Because I'd read about the experience, and I understand you, it was a pretty good one, just writing for yourself.
Yeah, you know, most of the jazz biographies are based on interviews. A musician will sit down with a professional writer and do hours of historic interviews, and then it's turned into a book. And for the last decade or so, I had thought about telling my story, my history, and that sort of thing. And the more I got into it, the more I thought I'd like to try to write it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a real lover of books. I've been a lifelong reader, and I have great admiration for people who can really write well. So I thought I would try it. And if I got into it and it wasn't measuring up, I would shift gears and get someone to help me with it. But it took me several years. I would work at it for a while, and then I would run out of energy and focus and put it aside for a year or so, and then I would get back into it and so on. But eventually finished it. A friend of mine, a writer from Chicago, offered to be my editor, meaning to go through it and make suggestions about changing the organization. You know, we'll put this story probably belongs over here in this chapter and that sort of thing. Then about 6 months or so, we finished it. And I was especially thrilled when, after it came out, it was selected as the Jazz Book of the Year by the Jazz Journalists Association.
Oh, beautiful.
That's about 300 jazz writers who every year select the best liner notes of the year, the best
books, categories
of writing.
Right.
And I never imagined that they would pick someone who was not a professional writer for the award, and they completely blew me away when I got the call that they had chosen Learning to Listen as the book for that year. So I'm really proud of it. I tried to tell not only my story, being my history in jazz, people I've played with and who were big influences on me and that sort of thing, but also my personal story of self-discovery as a person, and also my understanding of how jazz and how improvisation, which is sort of the main focus of jazz, works. Over the years, I've been asked thousands of times, well, when you're up there playing and you have no music in front of you or anything, how do you know what to play next? You know, how do you choose the notes? How does it work? It's kind of mysterious. And of course, I've been a teacher most of my career as well, and I've had to explain and demonstrate and show how this is done to hundreds and hundreds of students. So I thought I wanted to include that in the book as well, so that maybe people could get more of an understanding of the mental process that all us musicians go through when we're up there playing.
We really enjoy that kind of information. And this was actually your second book, because your first one was...
Yes, I did. I wrote a book about how to tour on the road. It started out as a loose leaf folder of instructions to road managers. You know, road managers come and go.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like every year or two I was hiring somebody else and having to teach them how to do things. So I made up kind of a guide set of instructions. And my manager saw it one day and said, wow, this could be great. I said, oh, come on. And he said, listen, if I find a publisher for this, will you go ahead and turn it into a book? And I jokingly said yes. And then pretty soon he got Billboard magazines interested in publishing it. So I indeed turned it into a book. It's out of print now, and probably just as well. It's a little out of date 35 years later or whatever it is. Yeah, that was my first literary excursion.
And that was released in 1981. And Learning to Listen, that was 2013?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And it is still in print, thank goodness.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, go on Amazon and there it is.
That's right.
You can find it.
were born in Indiana.
Yes. Grew up in a little farm town, not the most likely launch pad for being a jazz musician. I started out just playing classical music and sort of light popular music, songs that were played on the radio back in the 1950s. And jazz just happened to come along. The first record I heard, somehow, I don't even know how I ended up with it, was a Benny Goodman record. And I was just blown away by the energy and the excitement of this music. And so that got me started looking for other jazz records. I was probably 12 or 13, something like that, at the time, and discovered a record store about an hour away in a larger town. And each Saturday, my father would drive me down to Evansville, that was the city, and I would hit the record store and see what new jazz records had come in and buy one or two and gradually built a collection and so on. And meanwhile, starting to copy and learn how to improvise and imitate what I was hearing on the record.
Now, all the while, you're playing vibraphone?
Yes, I played marimba and vibraphone at first. Mostly it was like classical pieces on the marimba and popular music on the vibraphone. And I say popular as opposed to jazz because at first my vibraphone repertoire was just standards of the day, like the Tennessee Waltz and so on, you know, whatever was on the radio at the time.
Right.
By the time I was midway through high school, I was a devoted jazz guy. I listened to the records. I imitated them. I was learning how to play as fast as I could and also starting to find other kid musicians, other high school players down in Evansville that I could get together with on weekends and have jam sessions with and start to sit in at local clubs as well where there would be a sort of a jazz-flavored trio or something. I would go in and join in occasionally and try to get some playing experience.
Well, how did you decide to stick with the vibraphone? What was it about that?
Well, in jazz, you don't hear the marimba much. And meanwhile, for the vibraphone, well, there was Lionel Hampton and Milt Jackson and Red Narvo and all these guys. So I just gravitated to, when I heard mallet instruments in the jazz world, it was always the vibraphone.
Right.
So by the time I was finishing high school, I had sold the marimba and I just played the vibes. As of the end of high school, I had decided to try to be a musician. And the big change came when I went to the first ever jazz band camp, which happened to be at Indiana University, a couple hours from where I lived. And so I signed up and went with my vibes. And up to that point, I was planning on going to college to either be a doctor or an engineer or something. Mm-hmm. I was a straight-A student, and my father was a chemical engineer, and this was sort of what I thought would be a sensible direction, and music was a hobby and fun. But after a week of working with these professional musicians who were teachers and other kids like myself who were gung-ho jazz enthusiasts, I came home so excited that I told my parents, I've changed my plan. I'm going to go to jazz school and try to become a musician. And to their credit, they didn't blink. They said, all right, we hope it goes well. And I signed up for one of the two jazz schools in the country at that time. So we have hundreds of them, thousands of them now.
Right.
But in 1960, when I was finishing high school, there was Berklee College of Music in Boston and North Texas down in Texas. So I picked Berklee and planned to go there after I finished high school.
You eventually wound up teaching there, right?
I did. You know, I was a student, then I moved to New York and lived there about 10 years, got my career established, and then I got an interest in teaching. I started doing clinics, they call them, or master classes. That was a new thing back in the 60s for jazz musicians to go into schools or music stores or whatever and do a kind of one-hour presentation or something about your playing. And I started doing some of those because it was some extra work and seemed fun. And I discovered that it came pretty naturally to me to explain what I was doing and to talk about it. And not all musicians are that verbal.
Very true.
Some are, but some aren't. And they're wonderful players, but aren't sure how to go about talking about it.
Right.
And in my case, that was a pretty natural thing for me. So at a certain point, I talked to the people at Berkeley and said, I'm thinking about getting more into this. What do you think? And they said, oh, we'd love to try it. So I moved to Boston. That was 1971. And I started as a teacher, and I was there for 33 years.
Wow.
First as a teacher, then later, sort of 10-year periods. I was there, first taught for 10 years, and the second 10 years I was a dean.
Oh, okay.
And then the last 10 years, I was the vice president.
Oh, wow. Well, I know as a teacher, you're a teacher. As a dean and a vice president, how were your responsibilities altered?
Well, I became more the overseer of areas of the school. As a dean, it was the dean of curriculum, overseeing the 600 courses that the school offered, and kind of supervising groups of teachers and working with the chairman of the different departments and so on. And as a vice president, I ran the school. The president's main focus is fundraising at colleges,
right,
and working with the trustees to carry this sort of thing out. And my job as executive vice president was to oversee the day-to-day running of the school. So by then, my teaching days were over, but in a way, I was still making a lot of educational decisions, deciding what areas to support and how to sort of guide them and direct them. And I think my experience as a working musician with a history in the business helped me make the right judgment calls when things would come up. Well, should we fund this project or that project? Or it's every day was essentially a day of making decisions about one thing or another. And I essentially made my choices based on my experience as a musician. And it seemed to work out. The school has been, of course, a tremendous success story, and only in small part to do with my efforts. I mean, it's an amazing, vibrant institution, which certainly continues on today as an amazing place.
On the subject of institutions, you're basically self-taught, as are a lot of people of your generation, in the music. Do you believe that musicians who are self-taught today would be able to move in the direction that a lot of you have? I mean, to be able to teach in institutions, I mean, it doesn't appear that way.
I would say it would be much more challenging.
Yeah.
For someone to manage that. You think back to the 1920s, 30s, 40s, almost all jazz musicians were self-taught. They learned from other musicians,
right,
on the band, on the road while they traveled.
Right.
And they had sort of an incomplete musical background. Maybe they didn't sight read too well, but they could improvise well. Or maybe they could do some things. They knew harmony, kind of, but not real well, but they got by because their ear was pretty good and so on. By the time jazz had become much more sophisticated and modernized, you couldn't get away with guessing and playing by ear and so on. You had to be able to read music and understand how it's put together and be essentially a trained musician. So I think today it's a different experience for the young players coming up today.
I want to go back to your playing long ago with someone I wasn't aware of, and I just became familiar with as a result of researching the discussion that I'm having with you now, Hank Garland. Thank you.
My big break.
Yeah.
If there is such a thing in the music business. There I was, close to finishing high school in Princeton, Indiana. And meanwhile, in Nashville, Tennessee, in the middle of the country music scene, the number one studio guitar player by the name of Hank Garland had become a big jazz buff. And he was a very talented musician, and he had learned how to play jazz quite well. And he convinced his record label, which was Columbia, CBS Records, instead of making a country record this time, let him make a jazz record. And turned out that he was really interested in the sound of guitar and vibraphone. But there were no vibraphone players in Nashville, in the country world. And he mentioned this one day at a recording session to some of the other musicians, and a saxophone player who happened to know me said, well, you know, there's a kid up in Indiana you might want to hear. So a month or so later, with this saxophone player, I rode down, it's about 4 hours from where I lived, in the car. We drove down to Nashville, and I set up the vibes, and we played a couple of songs together before some record date started. And based on that, Hank turned to me and said, well, what are your plans? And I said, well, I've got a month more of high school, and then in the fall, I'm going to Boston to college. So he proposed that I move to Nashville for the summer, and that we would play weekends at a club, and also make this record that he was planning to make. So, well, that sounded pretty fantastic to me. So as soon as school was over, I loaded up my stuff and drove to Nashville and found an apartment for the summer, and we started playing together and made that record. And that itself was an amazing experience. But in addition, one of our fans, a fellow who had taken to coming in to hear us play at the club every week or two, was the musician Chet Atkins.
Oh, another guitarist.
Another guitarist, a big country star, and yeah. Also the head of RCA Records in Nashville. And he convinced the New York RCA folks that they should sign me to a record contract.
Wow.
So my last week in Nashville, he called me up and said, we want to offer you a contract. And so I headed off to Berkeley with a record contract already.
Wow.
And I was 17 years old, and I could hardly believe all this was happening. And so I got a real early start in the business as a result of this interesting side trip through Nashville, of all places. I'm sure I'm the only person that's launched a jazz career in the heart of country music.
I don't know. There's also Charlie Hayden.
Well, that's true, although he wasn't in Nashville. He was
that's
in
true.
Somewhere, or Oklahoma or something.
Missouri,
yes. Yeah. I knew it was somewhere out there. And then, well, of course, there was Bella Fleck, who
right.
definitely was Nashville.
Right.
And he's become a jazz star
exactly.
as well. So it does happen.
I really just am amazed by the, I don't know, just the combination of sounds between a guitar and a vibraphone. It's just...
It's a combination that, you know, I was introduced to by Hank, because
mm-hmm.
it was his idea to have this instrumentation.
Right.
But over the years, I have continued much of the time to have guitar and vibraphone as the basis of my bands. It's a combination that, sound-wise, has a dual function. The two instruments can play separately and sound distinct from each other. And they can accompany each other. You can also play it in unison together, and it blends and sounds like another instrument, like
yes.
a combination, the guitar vibe.
Yes.
You know, and so orchestrationally, it gives you these different possibilities. And these days, you know, it's hard to tour with a group of 7 or 8 instruments. You try to limit it to a smaller combination, but you want to get as much variety and range out of the group that you can, and it turns out the guitar and vibe combination really worked well for me. So probably 3/4 of the 40-some years that I've had a band, that's been my lineup. I've also had groups with piano or with saxophones or trumpet or something, but I keep coming back to the guitar vibe front line.
wind up hiring Pat Metheny?
Well, actually, he found me.
Oh.
I had a band for about 4 or 5 years by that time with guitar players. And he was a young kid growing up in Missouri and then started going to college in Florida, in Miami. Unbeknownst to me, he was a big fan of my band and my records. And he found out that I was going to be playing at a jazz festival hosted by a college, a kind of a small affair in Wichita, Kansas. And because he was from Missouri and from Kansas area there, he knew the people at this festival, and he found out I was going to be there. So he got himself invited, and he took the bus, of all things, all the way from Miami to Wichita.
Wow.
With the hopes of getting to play with me and at least to meet me and so on. So he walked up to me while I was rehearsing with the college band and introduced himself and said he really would like to play with me and could he sit in? And at first I said, well, no, this is not a good situation. I'm here to play with this college band and everything. But he said, but, you know, I know all your songs.
Oh.
I said, which was interesting. And so we ended up, in fact, playing a couple of tunes together that night. And I heard him play with a little student group that he had performed with. And he was really talented. He showed a lot of natural ability. And we had a long conversation about, you know, what should he do next now that he was 18 years old and living in Florida. And I said, well, get somewhere where there's more of a music scene. Go to New York, go to Boston, most likely one of those two places. So he came to Boston because, you know, he knew me by that time. And within a short while, I had decided to add him to my band. And we started playing together, and that went on for 3 or 4 years. And by that time, he was getting quite a following in his own right going on, and we had made several records together already. And it was just the perfect transition for him to start his own band and start making his own records. And, well, the rest is history as far as Pat's career is concerned.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. What you're listening to right now is Walter L. from Gary Burton, Pat Metheny, Steve Swallow, Antonio Sanchez, Quartet Live. That's a 2009 Concord Music release. Of course, that is Gary Burton on vibraphone, Pat Metheny on guitar, Steve Swallow on bass, and Antonio Sanchez on drums. Before that, we heard the title track from Like Minds. That's a 1998 Concord Records release. Gary Burton on vibraphone, Chick Corea on piano, Pat Metheny on guitar, Roy Haynes on drums, and Dave Holland on bass. Before that, we heard Riotous and that is Hank Garland from a compilation Move, the Guitar Artistry of Hank Garland. That's a 2001 Sundazed Records release, originally recorded between 1959 and 1960. Before that, we heard General Mojo Laid Plan. That's the Gary Burton Quartet from Very Touchy. This is an import. It seemed to have only been released as a Japanese import. Originally recorded in 1969, a 1996 Studio Songs release. It has Gary Burton on vibraphone, David Pritchard on guitar, Steve Swallow on bass, and Billy Goodwin on drums. Before that, we heard 1-2-1-2-3-4, Gary Burton from Duster. His 1967 RCA release, Gary Burton on vibraphone, Larry Coryell on guitar, Roy Haynes on drums, and Steve Swallow on bass. Before that, we heard our theme, Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972. This is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation, and this song was originally recorded in 1967. Coming up next is On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Oh, by the way, that is Wendy Oxenhorn of the Jazz Foundation. Just make sure we get her name completely right. Congratulations to her and all the other recipients of the NEA Jazz Master. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 29th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's guest is vibraphonist Gary Burton. He has no immediate upcoming New York City area performances, but we'll let you know when he'll be around again. And we have lots more music for you this week. Poet Jessica Kerr Moore is at the Blue Note with pianist Mark Carey on November 30th. Also on the 30th, pianist Randy Weston is at New School University's Tishman Auditorium with Senegalese master drummers for a tribute. Pianist Mark Carey hosts the Harlem Sessions at the Gin Fizz on December 3rd and 10th. And bassist Christian McBride leads two different trios at the Village Vanguard from December 1st through 6th and 8th through 13th. Jeff Lieberman's The Amazing Nina Simone documentary film is in Hudson, New York at Time and Space from December 3rd through 10th, and Hartford, Connecticut's Real Artways from the 11th to 17th. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria is at Baruch College's Performing Arts Center with Gene Marlowe's Heritage Ensemble on the 8th. Douglas York plays with Wadada Leo Smith at Roulette in Brooklyn on the 10th as part of the 50th anniversary celebration of AACM New York. Drummer Michael Carvin is at Kitano on the 11th and 12th. Saxophonist Papa Lou Donaldson leads a quartet at Flushing Down Hall on December 12th. And blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at the Turning Point in Piermont, New York on the 12th. Organist John Medeski is at the Stone with John Zorn on the 13th. Finally, pianist Jerry Allen is at the Village Vanguard from the 15th through the 20th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. You can also find playlists and audio from this and previous shows on our website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our biweekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, December 13th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Your mama. Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
And presently you're working with Julian Lage.
Yes, Julian, I saw him on a television show.
Oh.
He was 12 years old.
Wow.
And he played just briefly, and I was so impressed with how musical it was, his little jazz solo on a blues or something. And I called up and found out who he was and where he was living and growing with his parents in California. And so I called him up and talked to them, and I invited him to come and play with me at an informal conference thing that I was doing in California that was not too far from where they lived. That went so well. I was so impressed with his early abilities even then that we started playing occasional gigs together. Low-key things where he and his father would fly out to somewhere and we'd play two nights somewhere in Pennsylvania or whatever. And next thing I knew, he was 15 and playing better than ever. And we made our first record together and started also really touring together some. And by the time he was 17, we made our second record together, and he was finishing high school and coming on to Berkeley to go to college, and we've been playing together now for 12, 13 years. He's 26, I think, now.
Oh, goodness.
Or maybe 27, something like that, and has matured into just a fantastic all-around musician and really one of the big stars on guitar these days. Thank you.
played actually on our little community WBAI Pacifica station. At one point, we had International Working Women's Day live performances, and I had met a singer, a vocalist, Tana Alexa, and she was... Well, I had invited her on to sing because we generally like to have women on International Working Women's Day, accompanied by women. And she said, you know, I'm having a problem finding a woman guitarist. Could I bring this guy? And I was like, sure, of course, of course. And it turns out to be Julian Lage.
Yeah,
so it was
sure
wonderful.
Well, you know, Donna is married to Antonio Sanchez.
Yes.
Who has been my drummer for the last 4 or 5 years.
Ah, you and Pat Metheny.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
Longer with Pat.
We share him.
Right.
And so that's how Julian, of course, ended up knowing her and playing with her frequently. So we're all connected here.
Beautiful. I skipped over the time that you spent with George Shearing.
Okay.
And I'm wondering how that happened. How did you wind up working with him?
Well, I moved to New York when I was 19. I left Berkeley and decided, okay, I'm going to try getting established in New York. And if it doesn't work out, I'll go back to Berkeley and stay in school for a while longer. And among the first people I met and got to know was Marion McPartland.
Oh, yes.
And Marianne, of course, was British,
mm-hmm.
and friends with George Shearing.
Oh, okay.
And George Shearing was one of the few bands that actually had vibraphone as a regular instrument.
Oh.
One of the challenges of being a vibist is, you know, nobody's looking for a vibraphone player. You kind of have to end up leading your own band because not too many bands, you know, they're looking for a piano player and a bass player and maybe a trumpet or some. Vibes isn't the top of the list as a rule. But George was used to playing with vibes. And so she recommended me, and I got a call. I had been in New York about 3 months, hoping for work, trying to get introduced around town, meeting players and so on, and got a call to come and audition for George. which I did, and he immediately wanted to hire me for his band. But the issue was that he was taking several months off to go to guide dog school.
Oh.
He'd never had a guide dog before, a lifetime of being blind.
Interesting.
But he decided he wanted to try this, so he said, I won't be starting to tour again until the first of the year, till January, which for me meant waiting another several months before this gig would start. And I was actually hoping I would find something else in the meantime, but I didn't.
Oh, no.
And finally, I kept borrowing money from my father to pay the rent.
Uh-oh.
And until, but I knew this job was there. I just had to be patient. And so finally, in the beginning of 63, I flew out to Los Angeles and started touring with Shearing's band. And I did that for a year, at which point George decided to also take some time off again from touring. And I was back in New York unemployed.
Oh.
Briefly, as it turned out. Because then I got a call to come and play with Stan Getz.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
And that was, again, a recommendation. Stan was looking for a piano player and had not found one after some time of looking. And he called up an old friend of his, Lou Levy, who was Peggy Lee's piano player, and said, can you recommend any piano players? And Lou said, well, I don't know of any, but I just saw a guy here recently playing the vibraphone with four mallets, and maybe that would work. It could be something different. And so I got the call to go audition for Stan and got the job, and I ended up staying with Stan for 3 years.
Okay.
Which actually put me in a good position to start my own band, because he was at the peak of his career then with the hit records and playing everywhere, major concerts and so on. And so it was great exposure for me. So by the time that 3 years had passed, I had enough visibility and following to manage to start my own band.
Thank you.
and it seems as though you've recorded so much as a leader.
Yeah, well, I got an early start because of that early recording contract mm-hmm. with RCA. I started recording when I was 17, and I think I'm up to 65, 66 records now that I've recorded as a leader over the years with, you know, every now and then I change labels. I mean, the longest association I had was 16 years with ECM Records.
And I was actually going to ask you about that relationship.
Uh-huh. That one, it was a new company just getting off the ground, and they proposed that I do a record with Chick Corea, mm-hmm. a duet record, because we had played a duet concert, and the head of the record company was there and saw it and said, this would be a great record, you guys should record it. And so we made the one record, and it was quite a success, and I enjoyed working with Manfred Eicher, the head of the label. So I ended up signing with ECM in 73, I think it was, and we recorded a lot over the next 16, 17 years.
Now, was that Crystal Silence that you were referencing?
That was the first record,
yes.
Exactly. And even that, we made the record not thinking it was that unusual. I mean, we thought it was kind of esoteric, the idea of a duet with no rhythm section and mm-hmm. so on. And we didn't expect much to happen with it. I was chicken myself. And even then, ECM was such a new label, they didn't even have a distributor in the U.S. The only way you could get the record was to buy it as an import.
Wow.
You had to order it, or there were a few stores that would order it and stock it and so on, but it wasn't widely available. And we figured it would just kind of slip under the radar. But the record came out, and we actually got a phone call from a university in Michigan that wanted to book us for a concert. And we thought, wow, that's terrific. We'll go play a concert. In fact, Pat Metheny was in my band at the time and said, oh, I love this record that you guys made, and this is probably the only chance I'll ever get to hear you play together. So I'm coming along to Michigan. I'll help carry the vibes.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, I'm going. So we flew out there, and we walked into the concert hall, and it was gigantic.
Wow.
4,000 people. I thought, oh, my goodness. There's going to be like 100 people down front and scattered around, and it's going to be like playing in a bowling alley. This is going to be a disaster. So time for the concert, and I look around the curtain, and it's totally full.
Wow.
It's sold out. Then I was scared of the opposite, which is how are two players on this big stage going to hold the attention of this huge audience with just piano and vibe. But we went out and played, and it was a nice success, and the requests for gigs kept coming in, and now, what, 44 years later, we're still going out every year, doing concerts and making new records and so on. It's been the longest association that I've had in my career.
Wow. And you were involved in the ECM tribute record this year?
Oh, yes. This was a tribute to one of the ECM family, a bass player who I had recorded with, Pat had recorded with. We all knew Eberhard Weber,
mm-hmm.
this German bassist who had a very unique sound and style and had a big following in his own right. And 5 years ago, he had a stroke and was unable to play anymore. The left side of his body was partially paralyzed. And so to celebrate his 75th birthday, we got this idea to gather a lot of the ECM family together. So Pat Metheny and myself and Jan Garbarek and Ralph Towner and three or four other people all gathered in Stuttgart, his hometown. And with the Stuttgart Radio Orchestra, we played two concerts and recorded it for the radio. We weren't actually thinking of it being a record at the time, but it turned out really well, and Manfred was there too, so he decided he would like to issue it as a recording. So it just came out. It's called The Homage to Eberhard Weber, and it features a 30-minute long, really mega work by Pat.
Wow.
who took previously recorded examples of Eberhard's playing and edited them into a series of improvisations, and then wrote this big suite that we played along with this recording.
Wow.
So which was kind of a technical feat as well. In fact, it was video. It wasn't even just audio. They were video recordings of him soloing on some concerts.
Oh, my.
And so when we did it live, you know, there was a big video screen with Eberhard himself up there playing, and we're playing along with him.
Oh, that's beautiful.
With all this new music that Pat had written to go with it. And so it was quite an event. We just did it again at the Detroit Jazz Festival in September. They got interested in having it, so we brought the video equipment and set it all up and did it again. And Pat did it a third time in Japan as well. So it's actually what started out as a one-time project has actually turned into have a bit of a life that's gone on a bit longer.
So it could actually make its way to New York, right?
It could. If, you know, anybody that's, you know, wants to put up the budget, I guess,
right.
to have a big ensemble and all that could do it. Mm-hmm. But we were surprised that it, you know, that it actually, that we got requests to repeat it. And we're really thrilled that the record is out. Very proud of it.
Well, I am annoyed at how fast time flies, but there are two things that I want to ask you about before we're done.
Okay, sure.
And one of them being Your love of tango and Astor Piazzolla.
Ah, yeah. I met Astor the first time on a tour with Stan Getz back in the 60s. We were touring South America, and we played a few gigs in Argentina, and we ended up playing opposite Piazzolla's group in Buenos Aires for two nights. And I never heard anything like this, this contemporary tango. I never even knew anything about tango, let alone modern tango. And I thought it was amazing, and I brought back an armload of records and so on, and never imagined I would have anything personally to do with tango music. But 20 years later, Astor showed up at one of my concerts in Paris and said hello, and then asked if I would be interested in trying some kind of project together. And I said yes, even though I had no idea if tango would be something I could do. But he wrote concerts worth of music for me to play with his group. And 6 months later, we did a tour, about half a year of concerts in Europe and Japan and a little bit in North America, and made a record. And that launched me into kind of the tango world. I've made three more tango records and videos since then with his musician. He passed away in the early 90s, but I've continued to get together with his musicians every 5 or 10 years or so and do another tour and make another record and so on. And so I've had a kind of a long association with tango music, and I really love it.
There's one song that you wrote, Remembering Tano. I think that is the most beautiful song.
Oh, well, thank you. I wrote it thinking about him. Mm-hmm. And when I was finished, I said, well, you know, I need to name it after him. And Tano was his nickname.
Okay.
Because he was from an Italian family, Italiano. And the guys in the band all called him Tano.
Ah, I see.
So I decided to choose that for the title.
Now, there's one thing that you mentioned in the book, and you can say, I don't want to talk about it if you want to. But you come out.
Oh, yeah. I don't mind talking about it.
Great.
I mean, I came out 25 years ago now.
Uh-huh.
So I've been, you know, openly gay for a long time. I'm married to my husband of 11 years now.
Hey.
And having a terrific second life. I mean, I was married originally, and I have two children who are now in their 30s, and I have grandchildren and so on. In a way, I've had an incredibly full family life, which has been wonderful for me. But I wrestled with sexual identity from the time I was a young man on into my adult life, and especially the era in which this was happening, it just didn't seem like there was any way I could pursue or explore even what it meant to be gay and still be a successful musician. So I just wouldn't let myself think about it or get very close to that.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, I found myself single again and in my 40s, and I said, you know, I really would like to answer some of these questions that I've had. And by that time, the world had also changed a lot. And things had evolved, and I finally came to the conclusion after some therapy and kind of studying on this for a while that, yes, I truly was a gay person and that I needed to live the second half of my life as the person that I discovered that I am. And I have to say, I've never had a really negative experience. I've never had anybody call me names or be mean to me or anything. I worried at first, well, would my musician friends feel awkward about working with me? Would people not call me for projects in the future? Would it affect my career in any way? But it hasn't at all. In fact, if anything, I've been more successful in the last 25 years than I was in the first.
Excellent.
You know, hopefully because I keep being a better musician. But certainly being gay hasn't caused me any problems.
Has it helped you be more expressive in your music?
I don't know. People ask this, and I even ask it. I mean, I can't say that I think my playing has become more fabulous or anything. but certainly I'm more comfortable with who I am.
Yeah.
And I feel that probably has been a positive factor in my creative abilities. It can only have been helpful, is my theory. But it wasn't as if I suddenly could play, you know, twice as good or anything like that.
Right.
But definitely I felt you know, like a big weight had been lifted.
Yes.
And in fact, people who come out will always say that.
Yes.
You know, they've lived for years keeping this secret and feeling like it's a burden. And then when it's gone, they feel like, wow, I feel liberated.
Right.
And that certainly happened to me.
Oh, wonderful. Now, I would really be wrong if I didn't ask you about the four mallet. How did you wind up being associated with it?
Well, I wasn't the first person to ever play with four mallets.
Right.
Players had messed around with this through the history of mallet players. And there were some xylophone players back in the 1920s and so on, who I see in old videos that were really pretty impressive. But in my case, I lived in this little town in Indiana, and I played alone for the most part. And it was too empty. I needed it to sound more complete. I wanted some harmony. I wanted the chords to fill in and so on. So I started at first just clumsily playing with four mallets on, you know, slow pieces until I kind of got a little bit of ability with it. And as the more I progressed, the more facility I had. And pretty soon I was playing pretty much with four mallets all the time. And so by the time I finished high school and was moving on to college and to getting my career started, I was a four mallet player. And this was the style that I had kind of arrived at. Most musicians go through a period of imitating the leading players of the day. And then out of that, you know, find their own voice.
Right.
In my case, the leading players of the day, the leading player, was Milt Jackson.
Ah, yes.
Who was a two mallet player. And he was my hero, my favorite player. But because of my technical situation of playing with four mallets, I didn't imitate him. I sort of found my own path. And for the first few years, I got a certain amount of feedback about, you know, that's not the way people play the vibes.
Mm.
Listen to Milt Jackson. That's how it's supposed to sound.
Oh, no.
And I was too late for me to switch gears and try to play a different way. I felt this is how I hear it. This is how I see it. I've got to keep going. And, of course, in the long run, if you have your own voice, you know, you're better off. You can stand out from the crowd. But at the beginning, it's a little bit of a burden to be different.
So one last question. Before the one last question, I want to remind people that there is the autobiography, Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton, that if you want to know more, this has just been a primer, this conversation, so you can find out everything and then some.
Thank you for mentioning that.
And it is available at your bookseller.
Mm-hmm.
The question being, Sweat.
What's coming next, maybe?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, my next larger project is I'm touring in January, February, and into April with the Mac Avenue Super Band, which
right.
is made up of artists from the Mac Avenue label, which is the record company I'm with now.
Right.
And we're going to be playing in New York.
Yay.
At Birdland.
Oh, yay!
The last week of January.
Okay.
We'll be there for a week with Sean Jones on trumpet, Tia Fuller on saxophone, the
yay.
Christian McBride Trio is the rhythm section.
Great.
And me.
Oh,
and,
wonderful.
And then we head off, you know, to 23 more concerts, you know, around the U.S. For our tour.
Oh, thank you so much for that information. I'm so
sure.
happy to hear that. And I am looking forward to the end of January so I could catch you at Birdland. And that's one of my favorite venues.
Yeah, I played there several times over the years. So we're looking forward to coming back.
Well, thank you so much, Gary Burton, for joining Sugar and My Bowl. I am so grateful. And congratulations.
You're welcome. And thank you very much. It was an enjoyable conversation, Joyce.
All right. You have a good night.
Okay. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening was Gary Burton. And what you're listening to right now is Remembering Tano from the new Gary Burton Quartet. That's the name of the release is Guided Tour, and that's a 2013 Mac Avenue Records release. The lineup on there is Gary Burton on vibraphone, Julian Lodge on guitar, Antonio Sanchez on drums, and Scott Coley on bass. And before that, we heard Senior Mouse from Chick Corea and Gary Burton. The name of the release is Crystal Silence. That's the 1973 ECM Records release. Before that, we heard So Many Things from Gary Burton, New Vibe Man in Town. That's Gary Burton's first release as a leader. That's a 1961 RCA release, which is a trio, which has Gene Chirico on bass and Joe Murillo on drums. Before that, we heard Here's That Rainy Day from Stan Getz. Getz a Go-Go. That's a 1964 Verve Records release, which features our guest for this evening, Gary Burton, on vibraphone. Before that, we heard Over the Rainbow, George Shearing, and this is from a compilation, The Definitive George Shearing, which was a 2002 Verve Records release, and it was originally recorded in 1963 with George Shearing on piano, Gary Burton on vibraphone, Roy Anthony on guitar, Gene Chirico on bass, and Vernell Fournier on drums. Before that, we heard Etude, which was composed by Julian Lage, and that is the new Gary Burton Quartet from Common Ground, 2011 Mack Avenue Records. Gary Burton on vibraphone, Julian Lage on guitar, Antonio Sanchez on drums, and Scott Coley on bass. And before that, we heard Clarity from New Generation. And the name of the group is also New Generation, which is Gary Burton on vibraphone, Julian Lage on guitar, Vadim Neslovsky on piano, and James Williams on drums, also Lukis Curtis on bass. This is a 2005 Concord Records release, and of course we heard on the bandstand with our associate producer Hank Williams. Before that, we send our condolences to the family of Simon Lokley. I used to see Simon Lokley when I would engineer during the fun drives on Saturday mornings. And we'd have conversations about this music, because he would play some of this music, sort of older periods of it, mostly swing, but it's always a good conversation when I would see Simon Lokley. So happy trails to Simon Lokley. Rest in peace. And we'll be back on Sunday, December 13th. La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.